Saladin regarded him with the warmest admiration, and when Richard, after his victory, demanded peace, willingly acceded. A truce was concluded for 3 years and 8 months, during which Christian pilgrims were to enjoy the liberty of visiting Jerusalem without hindrance or payment of any tax. The Crusaders were allowed to retain the cities of Tyre and Jaffa, with the country intervening. Saladin, with a princely generosity, invited many of the Christians to visit Jerusalem, and several of the leaders took advantage of his offer to feast their eyes upon a spot which all considered so sacred. Many of them were entertained for days in the Sultan's own palace, from which they returned with their tongues laden with the praises of the noble infidel. Richard and Saladin never met, though the impression that they did will remain on many minds who have been dazzled by the glorious fiction of Sir Walter Scott. But each admired the prowess and nobleness of soul of his rival, and agreed to terms far less onerous than either would have accepted had this mutual admiration not existed. Richard left a high reputation in Palestine. So much terror did his name occasion that the women of Syria used it to frighten their children for ages afterwards. Every disobedient child became still when told that King Richard was coming. Even men shared the panic that his name created. And 100 years afterwards, whenever a horse shied at any object in the way, his rider would exclaim, "What, dost thou think King Richard is in the bush?" The King of England no longer delayed his departure, for messengers from his own country brought imperative news that his presence was required to defeat the intrigues that were fomenting against his crown. His long imprisonment in the Austrian dominions and final ransom are too well known to be dwelt upon, and thus ended the Third Crusade, less destructive of human life than the two first, but quite as useless. The flame of popular enthusiasm now burned pale indeed, and all the efforts of popes and potentates were insufficient to rekindle it. At last, after flickering unsteadily like a lamp expiring in the socket, it burned up brightly for one final instant and was extinguished forever. The Fourth Crusade, as connected with popular feeling, requires little or no notice. At the death of Saladin, which happened a year after the conclusion of his truce with Richard of England, his vast empire fell to pieces. His brother Saif ad-Din, or Safadin, seized upon Syria, in the possession of which he was troubled by the sons of Saladin. When this intelligence reached Europe, the Pope, Celestin III, judged the moment favorable for preaching a new crusade. But every nation in Europe was unwilling and cold towards it. The people had no ardor, and the kings were occupied with more weighty matters at home. The only monarch of Europe who encouraged it was the Emperor Henry of Germany, under whose auspices the Dukes of Saxony and Bavaria took the field at the head of a considerable force. They landed in Palestine and found anything but a welcome from the Christian inhabitants. Under the mild sway of Saladin, they had enjoyed repose and toleration, and both were endangered by the arrival of the Germans. They looked upon them, in consequence, as over-officious intruders, and gave them no encouragement in the warfare against Saladin. The result of this crusade was even more disastrous than the last, for the Germans contrived not only to embitter the Saracens against the Christians of Judea, but to lose the strong city of Jaffa, and cause the destruction of 9/10 of the army with which they had quitted Europe. And so ended the Fourth Crusade. The Fifth was more important, and had a result which its projectors never dreamed of, no less than the sacking of Constantinople and the placing of a French dynasty upon the imperial throne of the Eastern Caesars. Each succeeding pope, however much he may have differed from his predecessors on other points, zealously agreed in one, that of maintaining by every possible means the papal ascendancy. No scheme was so likely to aid in this endeavor as the Crusades. As long as they could persuade the kings and nobles of Europe to fight and die in Syria, their own sway was secured over the minds of men at home. Such being their object, they never inquired whether a crusade was or was not likely to be successful, whether the time were well or ill chosen, or whether men and money could be procured in sufficient abundance. Pope Innocent III would have been proud if he could have bent the refractory monarchs of England and France into so much submission. But John and Philip Augustus were both engaged. Both had deeply offended the Church and had been laid under her ban, and both were occupied in important reforms at home. Philip in bestowing immunities upon his subjects, and John in having them forced from him. The emissaries of the Pope therefore plied them in vain, but as in the First and Second Crusades, the eloquence of a powerful preacher incited the nobility, and through them a certain portion of the people. Fulk, Bishop of Neuilly, an ambitious and enterprising prelate, entered fully into the views of the court of Rome and preached the crusade wherever he could find an audience. Chance favored him to a degree he did not himself expect, for he had in general found but few proselytes, and those few but cold in the cause. Theobald, Count of Champagne, had instituted a grand tournament to which he had invited all the nobles from far and near. Upwards of 2,000 knights were present with their retainers, besides a vast concourse of people to witness the sports. In the midst of the festivities, Fulk arrived upon the spot, and, conceiving the opportunity to be a favorable one, he addressed the multitude in eloquent language, and passionately called upon them to enroll themselves for the new crusade. The Count de Champagne, young, ardent, and easily excited, received the cross at his hands. The enthusiasm spread rapidly. Charles, Count of Blois, followed the example, and of the 2,000 knights present, scarcely 150 refused. The popular frenzy seemed on the point of breaking out as in the days of yore. The Count of Flanders, the Count of Bar, the Duke of Burgundy, and the Marquis of Montferrat brought all their vassals to swell the train, and in a very short space of time an effective army was on foot and ready to march to Palestine. The dangers of an overland journey were too well understood, and the crusaders endeavored to make a contract with some of the Italian states to convey them over in their vessels. Dandolo, the aged Doge of Venice, offered them the galleys of the Republic. But the crusaders, on their arrival in that city, found themselves too poor to pay even half the sum demanded. Every means was tried to raise the money. The crusaders melted down their plate, and ladies gave up their trinkets. Contributions were solicited from the faithful, but came in so slowly as to make it evident to all concerned that the faithful of Europe were outnumbered by the prudent. As a last resource, Dandolo offered to convey them to Palestine at the expense of the Republic, if they would previously aid in the recapture of the city of Zara, which had been seized from the Venetians a short time previously by the King of Hungary. The crusaders consented, much to the displeasure of the Pope, who threatened excommunication upon all who should be turned aside from the voyage to Jerusalem. But notwithstanding the fulminations of the Church, the expedition never reached Palestine. The siege of Zara was speedily undertaken. After a long and brave defense, the city surrendered at discretion, and the crusaders were free, if they had so chosen it, to use their swords against the Saracens. But the ambition of the chiefs had been directed by unforeseen circumstances elsewhere. After the death of Manuel Comnenus, the Greek Empire had fallen a prey to intestine divisions. His son Alexius II had succeeded him, but was murdered after a short reign by his uncle Andronicus, who seized upon the throne. His reign also was but of short duration. Isaac Angelus, a member of the same family, took up arms against the usurper, and having defeated and captured him in a pitched battle, had him put to death. He also mounted the throne, only to be cast down from it. His brother Alexius deposed him, and to incapacitate him from reigning, put out his eyes and shut him up in a dungeon. Neither was Alexius III allowed to remain in peaceable possession of the throne. The son of the unhappy Isaac, whose name also was Alexius, fled from Constantinople, and hearing that the crusaders had undertaken the siege of Zara, made them the most magnificent offers, if they would afterwards aid him in deposing his uncle. His offers were that if by their means he was re-established in his father's dominions, he would place the Greek Church under the authority of the Pope of Rome, lend the whole force of the Greek Empire to the conquest of Palestine, and distribute 200,000 marks of silver among the crusading army. The offer was accepted, with a proviso on the part of some of the leaders that they should be free to abandon the design if it met with the disapproval of the Pope. But this was not to be feared. The submission of the schismatic Greeks to the See of Rome was a greater bribe to the pontiff than the utter annihilation of the Saracen power in Palestine would have been. The Crusaders were soon in movement for the imperial city. Their operations were skillfully and courageously directed and spread such dismay as to paralyze the efforts of the usurper to retain possession of his throne. After a vain resistance, he abandoned the city to its fate and fled no one knew whither. The aged and blind Isaac was taken from his dungeon by his subjects and placed upon the throne ere the Crusaders were apprised of the flight of his rival. His son, Alexius IV, was afterwards associated with him in the sovereignty. But the conditions of the treaty gave offense to the Grecian people, whose prelates refused to place themselves under the dominion of the See of Rome. Alexius at first endeavored to persuade his subjects to admission, and prayed the Crusaders to remain in Constantinople until they had fortified him in the possession of a throne which was yet far from secure. He soon became unpopular with his subjects, and breaking faith with regard to the subsidies, he offended the Crusaders. War was at length declared upon him by both parties, by his people for his tyranny and by his former friends for his treachery. He was seized in his palace by his own guards and thrown into prison, while the Crusaders were making ready to besiege his capital. The Greeks immediately proceeded to the election of a new monarch, and looking about for a man of courage, energy, and perseverance, they fixed upon Alexius Ducas, who, with almost every bad quality, was possessed of the virtues they needed. He ascended the throne under the name of Mercifulus. One of his first acts was to rid himself of his youngest predecessor. A broken heart had already removed the blind old Isaac, no longer a stumbling block in his way, and the young Alexius was soon put to death in his prison. War to the knife was now declared between the Greeks and the Franks, and early in the spring of the year 1204, preparations were commenced for an assault upon Constantinople. The French and Venetians entered into a treaty for the division of the spoils among their soldiery. For so confident were they of success that failure never once entered into their calculations. This confidence led them on to victory, while the Greeks, cowardly as treacherous people always are, were paralyzed by a foreboding of evil. It has been a matter of astonishment to all historians that Mercifulus, with the reputation for courage which he had acquired and the immense resources at his disposal, took no better measures to repel the onset of the Crusaders. Their numbers were as a mere handful in comparison with those which he could have brought against them, and if they had the hopes of plunder to lead them on, the Greeks had their homes to fight for and their very existence as a nation to protect. After an impetuous assault, repulsed for one day but renewed with double impetuosity on another, the Crusaders lashed their vessels against the walls, slew every man who opposed them, and with little loss to themselves entered the city. Mercifulus fled, and Constantinople was given over to be pillaged by the victors. The wealth they found was enormous. In money alone there was sufficient to distribute 20 marks of silver to each knight, 10 to each squire or servant-at-arms, and 5 to each archer. Jewels, velvets, silks, and every luxury of attire, with rare wines and fruits, and valuable merchandise of every description, also fell into their hands, and were bought by the trading Venetians, and the proceeds distributed among the army. 2,000 persons were put to the sword. But had there been less plunder to take up the attention of the victors, the slaughter would in all probability have been much greater. In many of the bloody wars which defile the page of history, we find that soldiers, utterly reckless of the works of God, will destroy his masterpiece, man, with unsparing brutality, but linger with respect round the beautiful works of art. They will slaughter women and children, but spare a picture. They will hew down the sick, the helpless, and the hoary-headed, but refrain from injuring a fine piece of sculpture. The Latins, on their entrance into Constantinople, respected neither the works of God nor man, but vented their brutal ferocity upon the one and satisfied their avarice upon the other. Many beautiful bronze statues, above all price as works of art, were broken into pieces to be sold as old metal. The finely chiseled marble, which could be put to no such vile uses, was also destroyed with a recklessness, if possible, still more atrocious. The following is a list of some of the works of art thus destroyed from Nicetas, a contemporary Greek author. First, a colossal Juno from the Forum of Constantine, the head of which was so large that four horses could scarcely draw it from the place where it stood to the palace. Second, the statue of Paris, presenting the apple to Venus. Third, an immense bronze pyramid crowned with a female figure which turned with the wind. Fourth, the colossal statue of Bellerophon in bronze, which was broken down and cast into the furnace. Under the inner nail of the horse's hind foot on the left side was found a seal wrapped in a woolen cloth. Fifth, a figure of Hercules by Lysimachus, of such vast dimensions that the thumb was equal in circumference to the waist of a man. Sixth, the ass and his driver, cast by order of Augustus after the Battle of Actium, in commemoration of his having discovered the position of Anthony through the means of an ass driver. Seventh, the wolf suckling the twins of Rome. Eighth, the gladiator in combat with a lion. Ninth, the hippopotamus. Tenth, the sphinxes. 11th, an eagle fighting with a serpent. 12th, a beautiful statue of Helen. 13th, a group with a monster somewhat resembling a bull engaged in deadly conflict with a serpent, and many other works of art too numerous to mention. The carnage being over and the spoil distributed, 6 persons were chosen from among the Franks and 6 from among the Venetians, who were to meet and elect an emperor, previously binding themselves by oath to select the individual best qualified among the candidates. The choice wavered between Baldwin, Count of Flanders, and Boniface, Marquis of Montferrat, but fell eventually upon the former. He was straightway robed in the imperial purple and became the founder of a new dynasty. He did not live long to enjoy his power or to consolidate it for his successors, who, in their turn, were soon swept away. In less than 60 years, the rule of the Franks at Constantinople was brought to as sudden and disastrous a termination as the reign of Mirzaphlus. And this was the grand result of the Fifth Crusade. Pope Innocent III, although he had looked with no very unfavorable eye upon these proceedings, regretted that nothing had been done for the relief of the Holy Land. Still, upon every convenient occasion, he enforced the necessity of a new crusade. Until the year 1213, his exhortations had no other effect than to keep the subject in the mind of Europe. Every spring and summer, detachments of pilgrims continued to set out for Palestine to the aid of their brethren, but not in sufficient numbers to be of much service. These periodical passages were called the Passagium Martii, or the Passage of March, and the Passagium Johannis, or the Passage of the Festival of St. John. These did not consist entirely of soldiers armed against the Saracen, but of pilgrims led by devotion, and in performance of their vows, bearing nothing with them but their staff and their wallet. Early in the spring of 1213, a more extraordinary body of crusaders was raised in France and Germany. An immense number of boys and girls, amounting, according to some accounts, to 30,000, were incited by the persuasion of 2 monks to undertake the journey to Palestine. They were no doubt composed of the idle and deserted children who generally swarm in great cities, nurtured in vice and daring and ready for anything. The object of the monks seems to have been the atrocious one of inveigling them into slave ships on pretense of sending them to Syria and selling them for slaves on the coast of Africa. Great numbers of these poor victims were shipped at Marseille, but the vessels, with the exception of 2 or 3, were wrecked on the shores of Italy and every soul perished. The remainder arrived safely in Africa and were bought up as slaves and sent off into the interior of the country. Another detachment arrived at Genoa, but the accomplices in this horrid plot, having taken no measures at that port, expecting them all at Marseille, they were induced to return to their homes by the Genoese. Fuller, in his quaint history of the Holy War, says that this crusade was done by the instinct of the devil, and he adds a reason which may provoke mirth now, but which was put forth by the worthy historian in all soberness and sincerity. He says, "The devil, being cloyed with the murdering of men, desired a cordial of children's blood to comfort his weak stomach, as epicures, when tired of mutton, resort to lamb for a change." It appears from other authors that the preaching of the vile monks had such an effect upon these deluded children that they ran about the country, exclaiming, "O Lord Jesus, restore thy cross to us," and that neither bolts nor bars, the fear of fathers nor the love of mothers, was sufficient to restrain them from journeying to Jerusalem. The details of these strange proceedings are exceedingly meager and confused, and none of the contemporary writers who mention the subject have thought it worthwhile to state the names of the monks who originated the scheme, or the fate they met for their wickedness. Two merchants of Marseille, who were to have shared in the profits, were, it is said, brought to justice for some other crime and suffered death. But we are not informed whether they divulged any circumstances relating to this matter. Pope Innocent III does not seem to have been aware that the causes of this juvenile crusade were such as have been stated, for upon being informed that numbers of them had taken the cross and were marching to the Holy Land, he exclaimed, "These children are awake while we sleep." He imagined, apparently, that the mind of Europe was still bent on the recovery of Palestine, and that the zeal of these children implied a sort of reproach upon his own lukewarmness. Very soon afterwards, he bestirred himself with more activity and sent an encyclical letter to the clergy of Christendom, urging them to preach a new crusade. As usual, a number of adventurous nobles who had nothing else to do enrolled themselves with their retainers. At a council of Lateran, which was held while these bands were collecting, Innocent announced that he himself would take the cross and lead the armies of Christ to the defense of his sepulchre. In all probability, he would have done so, for he was zealous enough, but death stepped in and destroyed his project ere it was ripe. His successor encouraged the crusade, though he refused to accompany it, and the armament continued in France, England, and Germany. No leaders of any importance joined it from the former countries. Andrew, King of Hungary, was the only monarch who had leisure or inclination to leave his dominions. The Dukes of Austria and Bavaria joined him with a considerable army of Germans, and marching to Spalatro, took ship for Cyprus and from thence to Acre. The whole conduct of the King of Hungary was marked by pusillanimity and irresolution. He found himself in the Holy Land at the head of a very efficient army. The Saracens were taken by surprise, and were for some weeks unprepared to offer any resistance to his arms. He defeated the first body sent to oppose him and marched towards Mount Tabor with the intention of seizing upon an important fortress which the Saracens had recently constructed. He arrived without impediment at the mount and might have easily taken it, but a sudden fit of cowardice came over him, and he returned to Acre without striking a blow. He very soon afterwards abandoned the enterprise altogether and returned to his own country. Tardy reinforcements arrived at intervals from Europe, and the Duke of Austria, now the chief leader of the expedition, had still sufficient forces at his command to trouble the Saracens very seriously. It was resolved by him, in council with the other chiefs, that the whole energy of the crusade should be directed upon Egypt, the seat of the Saracen power in its relationship to Palestine, and from whence were drawn the continual levies that were brought against them by the Sultan. Damietta, which commanded the river Nile and was one of the most important cities of Egypt, was chosen as the first point of attack. The siege was forthwith commenced and carried on with considerable energy until the crusaders gained possession of a tower, which projected into the middle of the stream and was looked upon as the very key of the city. While congratulating themselves upon this success and wasting in revelry the time which should have been employed in turning it to further advantage, they received the news of the death of the wise Sultan Saphaddin. His two sons, Kamel and Kuruddin, divided his empire between them. Syria and Palestine fell to the share of Kuruddin, while Egypt was consigned to the other brother, who had for some time exercised the functions of lieutenant of that country. Being unpopular among the Egyptians, they revolted against him, giving the Crusaders a finer opportunity for making a conquest than they had ever enjoyed before. But quarrelsome and licentious as they had been from time immemorial, they did not see that the favorable moment had come, or, seeing, could not profit by it. While they were reveling or fighting among themselves, under the walls of Damietta, the revolt was suppressed and Kamel firmly established on the throne of Egypt. In conjunction with his brother Coradine, his next care was to drive the Christians from Damietta, and for upwards of 3 months they bent all their efforts to throw in supplies to the besieged or draw on the besiegers to a general engagement. In neither were they successful, and the famine in Damietta became so dreadful that vermin of every description were thought luxuries and sold for exorbitant prices. A dead dog became more valuable than a live ox in time of prosperity. Unwholesome food brought on disease, and the city could hold out no longer for absolute want of men to defend the walls. Coradine and Kamel were alike interested in the preservation of so important a position, and, convinced of the certain fate of the city, they opened a conference with the crusading chiefs, offering to yield the whole of Palestine to the Christians upon the sole condition of the evacuation of Egypt. With a blindness and wrong-headedness almost incredible, these advantageous terms were refused, chiefly through the persuasion of Cardinal Pelagius, an ignorant and obstinate fanatic who urged upon the Duke of Austria and the French and English leaders that infidels never kept their word, that their offers were deceptive and merely intended to betray. The conferences were brought to an abrupt termination by the Crusaders and a last attack made upon the walls of Damietta. The besieged made but slight resistance, for they had no hope, and the Christians entered the city and found out of 70,000 people but 3,000 remaining, so fearful had been the ravages of the twin fiends, plague and famine. Several months were spent in Damietta. The climate either weakened the frames or obscured the understanding of the Christians, for after their conquest, they lost all energy and abandoned themselves more unscrupulously than ever to riot and debauchery. John of Brienne, who by right of his wife was the nominal sovereign of Jerusalem, was so disgusted with the pusillanimity, arrogance, and dissensions of the chiefs that he withdrew entirely from them and retired to Acre. Large bodies also returned to Europe, and Cardinal Pelagius was left at liberty to blast the whole enterprise whenever it pleased him. He managed to conciliate John of Brienne and marched forward with these combined forces to attack Cairo. It was only when he approached within a few hours' march of that city that he discovered the inadequacy of his army. He turned back immediately, but the Nile had risen since his departure, the sluices were opened, and there was no means of reaching Damietta. In this strait he sued for the peace he had formerly spurned, and happily for himself found the generous brothers Kamel and Coradine still willing to grant it. Damietta was soon afterwards given up, and the cardinal returned to Europe. John of Brienne retired to Acre to mourn the loss of his kingdom, embittered against the folly of his pretended friends, who had ruined where they should have aided him. And thus ended the Sixth Crusade. The Seventh was more successful. Frederick II, Emperor of Germany, had often vowed to lead his armies to the defense of Palestine, but was as often deterred from the journey by matters of more pressing importance. Coradine was a mild and enlightened monarch, and the Christians of Syria enjoyed repose and toleration under his rule. But John of Brienne was not willing to lose his kingdom without an effort, and the popes in Europe were ever willing to embroil the nations for the sake of extending their own power. No monarch of that age was capable of rendering more effective assistance than Frederick of Germany. To inspire him with more zeal, it was proposed that he should wed the young Princess Violante, daughter of John of Brienne, and heiress of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. Frederick consented with joy and eagerness. The princess was brought from Acre to Rome without delay, and her marriage celebrated on a scale of great magnificence. Her father, John of Brienne, abdicated all his rights in favor of his son-in-law. And Jerusalem had once more a king, who had not only the will but the power to enforce his claims. Preparations for the new crusade were immediately commenced, and in the course of 6 months the emperor was at the head of a well-disciplined army of 60,000 men. Matthew Paris informs us that an army of the same amount was gathered in England, and most of the writers upon the Crusades adopt his statement. When John of Brienne was in England, before his daughter's marriage with the emperor was thought of, praying for the aid of Henry III and his nobles to recover his lost kingdom, he did not meet with much encouragement. Grafton, in his chronicle, says he departed again without any great comfort. But when a man of more influence in European politics appeared upon the scene, the English nobles were as ready to sacrifice themselves in the cause as they had been in the time of Coeur de Lion. The army of Frederick encamped at Brundisium, but a pestilential disease having made its appearance among them, their departure was delayed for several months. In the meantime, the Empress Violante died in childbed. John of Brienne, who had already repented of his abdication, and was besides incensed against Frederick for many acts of neglect and insult, no sooner saw the only tie which bound them severed by the death of his daughter than he began to bestir himself and make interest with the Pope to undo what he had done and regain the honorary crown he had renounced. Pope Gregory IX, a man of a proud, unconciliating, and revengeful character, owed the emperor a grudge for many an act of disobedience to his authority, and encouraged the overtures of John of Brienne more than he should have done. Frederick, however, despised them both, and as soon as his army was convalescent, set sail for Acre. He had not been many days at sea when he was himself attacked with the malady and obliged to return to Otranto, the nearest port. Gregory, who had by this time decided in the interest of John of Brienne, excommunicated the emperor for returning from so holy an expedition on any pretext whatever. Frederick at first treated the excommunication with supreme contempt, but when he got well, he gave His Holiness to understand that he was not to be outraged with impunity, and sent some of his troops to ravage the papal territories. This, however, only made the matter worse, and Gregory dispatched messengers to Palestine forbidding the faithful, under severe pains and penalties, to hold any intercourse with the excommunicated emperor. Thus, between them both, the scheme which they had so much at heart bade fair to be as effectually ruined as even the Saracens could have wished. Frederick still continued his zeal in the crusade, for he was now king of Jerusalem, and fought for himself and not for Christendom or its representative, Pope Gregory. Hearing that John of Brienne was preparing to leave Europe, he lost no time in taking his own departure, and arrived safely at Acre. It was here that he first experienced the evil effects of excommunication. The Christians of Palestine refused to aid him in any way, and looked with distrust, if not with abhorrence, upon him. The Templars, Hospitallers, and other knights shared at first the general feeling, but they were not men to yield a blind obedience to a distant potentate, especially when it compromised their own interests. When, therefore, Frederick prepared to march upon Jerusalem without them, they joined his banners to a man. It is said that previous to quitting Europe, the German emperor had commenced a negotiation with the Sultan Kemal for the restoration of the Holy Land, and that Kemal, who was jealous of the ambition of his brother, Coradin, was willing to stipulate to that effect, on condition of being secured by Frederick in the possession of the more important territory of Egypt. But before the Crusaders reached Palestine, Kemal was relieved from all fears by the death of his brother. He nevertheless did not think it worthwhile to contest with the Crusaders the barren corner of the earth which had already been dyed with so much Christian and Saracen blood, and proposed a truce of 3 years, only stipulating in addition that the Moslems should be allowed to worship freely in the Temple of Jerusalem. This happy termination did not satisfy the bigoted Christians of Palestine. The tolerance they sought for themselves they were not willing to extend to others, and they complained bitterly of the privilege of free worship allowed to their opponents. Unmerited good fortune had made them insolent, and they contested the right of the emperor to become a party to any treaty as long as he remained under the ecclesiastical ban. Frederick was disgusted with his new subjects, but as the Templars and Hospitallers remained true to him, he marched to Jerusalem to be crowned. All the churches were shut against him, and he could not even find a priest to officiate at his coronation. He had despised the papal authority too long to quail at it now when it was so unjustifiably exerted, and as there was nobody to crown him, he very wisely crowned himself. He took the royal diadem from the altar with his own hands and boldly and proudly placed it on his brow. No shouts of an applauding populace made the welkin ring. No hymns of praise and triumph resounded from the ministers of religion. But 1,000 swords started from their scabbards to testify that their owners would defend the new monarch to the death. It was hardly to be expected that he would renounce for any long period the dominion of his native land for the uneasy crown and barren soil of Palestine. He had seen quite enough of his new subjects before he was 6 months among them, and more important interests called him home. John of Brienne, openly leagued with Pope Gregory against him, was actually employed in ravaging his territories at the head of a papal army. This intelligence decided his return. As a preliminary step, he made those who had contemned his authority feel to their sorrow that he was their master. He then set sail, loaded with the curses of Palestine. And thus ended the 7th Crusade, which, in spite of every obstacle and disadvantage, had been productive of more real service to the Holy Land than any that had gone before, a result solely attributable to the bravery of Frederick and the generosity of the Sultan Kamel. Soon after the emperor's departure, a new claimant started for the throne of Jerusalem, in the person of Alice, Queen of Cyprus, and half-sister of the Mary who, by her marriage, had transferred her right to John of Brienne. The grand military orders, however, clung to Frederick, and Alice was obliged to withdraw. So peaceful a termination to the Crusade did not give unmixed pleasure in Europe. The chivalry of France and England were unable to rest, and long before the conclusion of the truce were collecting their armies for an 8th expedition. In Palestine also the contentment was far from universal. Many petty Mohammedan states in the immediate vicinity were not parties to the truce, and harassed the frontier towns incessantly. The Templars, ever turbulent, waged bitter war with the Sultan of Aleppo, and in the end were almost exterminated. So great was the slaughter among them that Europe resounded with the sad story of their fate, and many a noble knight took arms to prevent the total destruction of an order associated with so many high and inspiring remembrances. Kamel, seeing the preparations that were making, thought that his generosity had been sufficiently shown, and the very day the truce was at an end, assumed the offensive, and marching forward to Jerusalem, took possession of it after routing the scanty forces of the Christians. Before this intelligence reached Europe, a large body of crusaders was on the march, headed by the King of Navarre, the Duke of Burgundy, the Count de Bretagne, and other leaders. On their arrival, they learned that Jerusalem had been taken, but that the Sultan was dead and his kingdom torn by rival claimants to the supreme power. The dissensions of their foes ought to have made them united, but as in all previous crusades, each feudal chief was master of his own host and acted upon his own responsibility and without reference to any general plan. The consequence was that nothing could be done. A temporary advantage was gained by one leader who had no means of improving it, while another was defeated without means of retrieving himself. Thus the war lingered till the Battle of Gaza, when the King of Navarre was defeated with great loss and compelled to save himself from total destruction by entering into a hard and oppressive treaty with the Emir of Karak. At this crisis, aid arrived from England, commanded by Richard, Earl of Cornwall, the namesake of Coeur de Lion and inheritor of his valor. His army was strong and full of hope. They had confidence in themselves and in their leader, and looked like men accustomed to victory. Their coming changed the aspect of affairs. The new Sultan of Egypt was at war with the Sultan of Damascus, and had not forces to oppose two enemies so powerful. He therefore sent messengers to meet the English Earl, offering an exchange of prisoners and the complete cession of the Holy Land. Richard, who had not come to fight for the mere sake of fighting, agreed at once to terms so advantageous and became the deliverer of Palestine without striking a blow. The Sultan of Egypt then turned his whole force against his Moslem enemies, and the Earl of Cornwall returned to Europe. Thus ended the Eighth Crusade, the most beneficial of all. Christendom had no further pretense for sending her fierce levies to the east. To all appearances, the holy wars were at an end. The Christians had entire possession of Jerusalem, Tripoli, Antioch, Edessa, Acre, Jaffa, and, in fact, of nearly all Judea. And could they have been at peace among themselves, they might have overcome without great difficulty the jealousy and hostility of their neighbors. A circumstance, as unforeseen as it was disastrous, blasted this fair prospect and reillumed for the last time the fervor and fury of the Crusades. Genghis Khan and his successors had swept over Asia like a tropical storm, overturning in their progress the landmarks of ages. Kingdom after kingdom was cast down as they issued innumerable from the far recesses of the north and east. And among others, the empire of Khorasmian was overrun by these all-conquering hordes. The Khorasmians, a fierce, uncivilized race, thus driven from their homes, spread themselves in their turn over the south of Asia with fire and sword, in search of a resting place. In their impetuous course, they directed themselves towards Egypt, whose sultan, unable to withstand the swarm that had cast their longing eyes on the fertile valleys of the Nile, endeavored to turn them from their course. For this purpose, he sent emissaries to Barbican, their leader, inviting them to settle in Palestine, and the offer being accepted by the wild horde, they entered the country before the Christians received the slightest intimation of their coming. It was as sudden as it was overwhelming. Onwards, like the Simoom, they came, burning and slaying, and were at the walls of Jerusalem before the inhabitants had time to look round them. They spared neither life nor property. They slew women and children and priests at the altar, and profaned even the graves of those who had slept for ages. They tore down every vestige of the Christian faith and committed horrors unparalleled in the history of warfare. About 7,000 of the inhabitants of Jerusalem sought safety in retreat, but before they were out of sight, the banner of the cross was hoisted upon the walls by the savage foe to decoy them back. The artifice was but too successful. The poor fugitives imagined that help had arrived from another direction and turned back to regain their homes. Nearly the whole of them were massacred, and the streets of Jerusalem ran with blood. The Templars, Hospitallers, and Teutonic Knights forgot their long and bitter animosities and joined hand in hand to rout out this desolating foe. They entrenched themselves in Jaffa with all the chivalry of Palestine that yet remained, and endeavored to engage the sultans of Emissa and Damascus to assist them against the common enemy. The aid obtained from the Moslems amounted at first to only 4,000 men, but with these reinforcements, Walter of Brienne, the lord of Jaffa, resolved to give battle to the Khorasmians. The conflict was as deadly as despair on the one side and unmitigated ferocity on the other could make it. It lasted with varying fortune for 2 days, when the Sultan of Emissa fled to his fortifications and Walter of Brienne fell into the enemy's hands. The brave knight was suspended by the arms to a cross in sight of the walls of Jaffa, and the Khorasminian leader declared that he should remain in that position until the city surrendered. Walter raised his feeble voice, not to advise surrender, but to command his soldiers to hold out to the last. But his gallantry was unavailing. So great had been the slaughter that out of the grand array of knights there now remained but 16 Hospitallers, 33 Templars, and 3 Teutonic Cavaliers. These, with the sad remnant of the army, fled to Acre, and the Khorasmians were masters of Palestine. The sultans of Syria preferred the Christians to this fierce horde for their neighbors. Even the sultan of Egypt began to regret the aid he had given to such barbarous foes, and united with those of Emissa and Damascus to root them from the land. The Khorasmians amounted to but 20,000 men, and were unable to resist the determined hostility which encompassed them on every side. The sultans defeated them in several engagements, and the peasantry rose up in masses to take vengeance upon them. Gradually their numbers were diminished. No mercy was shown them in defeat. Barbican, their leader, was slain, and after 5 years of desperate struggles they were finally extirpated, and Palestine became once more the territory of the Muslims. A short time previous to this devastating eruption, Louis IX fell sick in Paris and dreamed in the delirium of his fever that he saw the Christian and Moslem host fighting before Jerusalem, and the Christians defeated with great slaughter. The dream made a great impression on his superstitious mind, and he made a solemn vow that if ever he recovered his health, he would take a pilgrimage to the Holy Land. When the news of the misfortunes of Palestine and the awful massacres at Jerusalem and Jaffa arrived in Europe, St. Louis remembered him of his dream. More persuaded than ever that it was an intimation direct from heaven, he prepared to take the cross at the head of his armies and march to the deliverance of the Holy Sepulchre. From that moment he doffed the royal mantle of purple and ermine and dressed in the sober serge, becoming a pilgrim. All his thoughts were directed to the fulfillment of his design, and although his kingdom could but ill spare him, he made every preparation to leave it. Pope Innocent IV applauded his zeal and afforded him every assistance. He wrote to Henry III of England to forward the cause in his dominions, and called upon the clergy and laity all over Europe to contribute towards it. William Longsword, the celebrated Earl of Salisbury, took the cross at the head of a great number of valiant knights and soldiers. But the fanaticism of the people was not to be awakened either in France or England. Great armies were raised, but the masses no longer sympathized. Taxation had been the great cooler of zeal. It was no longer a disgrace even to a knight if he refused to take the cross. Rutebeuf, a French minstrel, who flourished about this time, 1250, composed a dialogue between a crusader and a non-crusader, which the reader will find translated in ways fabliaux. The crusader uses every argument to persuade the non-crusader to take up arms and forsake everything in the holy cause. But it is evident from the greater force of the arguments used by the non-crusader that he was the favorite of the minstrel. To a most urgent solicitation of his friend the crusader, he replies, "I read thee right, thou holdest good to this same land I straight should hie, and win it back with mickle blood, nor gain 1 foot of soil thereby. While here dejected and forlorn, my wife and babes are left to mourn. My goodly mansion rudely marred, all trusted to my dogs to guard. But I, fair comrade, well I wot, an ancient saw of pregnant wit, doth bid us keep what we have got, and troth I mean to follow it." This being the general feeling, it was not to be wondered at that Louis IX was occupied fully 3 years in organizing his forces and in making the necessary preparations for his departure. When all was ready, he set sail for Cyprus, accompanied by his queen, his 2 brothers, the Counts d'Anjou and d'Artois, and a long train of the noblest chivalry of France. His 3rd brother, the Count de Poitiers, remained behind to collect another corps of crusaders, and followed him in a few months afterwards. The army united at Cyprus and amounted to 50,000 men, exclusive of the English crusaders under William Longsword. Again, a pestilential disease made its appearance, to which many hundreds fell victims. It was in consequence found necessary to remain in Cyprus until the spring. Louis then embarked for Egypt with his whole host. But a violent tempest separated his fleet, and he arrived before Damietta with only a few 1,000 men. They were, however, impetuous and full of hope. And although the Sultan Malik Shah was drawn up on the shore with a force infinitely superior, it was resolved to attempt a landing without waiting the arrival of the rest of the army. Louis himself, in wild impatience, sprang from his boat and waded on shore, while his army, inspired by his enthusiastic bravery, followed, shouting the old war cry of the 1st Crusaders, "Dieu le veut! Dieu le veut!" A panic seized the Turks. A body of their cavalry attempted to bear down upon the crusaders, but the knights fixed their large shields deep in the sands of the shore and rested their lances upon them so that they projected above and formed a barrier so imposing that the Turks, afraid to breast it, turned round and fairly took to flight. At the moment of this panic, a false report was spread in the Saracen host that the Sultan had been slain. The confusion immediately became general. The deroute was complete. Damietta itself was abandoned, and the same night the victorious crusaders fixed their headquarters in that city. The soldiers who had been separated from their chief by the tempest arrived shortly afterwards, and Louis was in a position to justify the hope not only of the conquest of Palestine, but of Egypt itself. But too much confidence proved the bane of his army. They thought, as they had accomplished so much, that nothing more remained to be done, and gave themselves up to ease and luxury. When, by the command of Louis, they marched towards Cairo, they were no longer the same men. Success, instead of inspiring, had unnerved them. Debauchery had brought on disease, and disease was aggravated by the heat of a climate to which none of them were accustomed. Their progress towards Massoura, on the road to Cairo, was checked by the Thanesian Canal, on the banks of which the Saracens were drawn up to dispute the passage. Louis gave orders that a bridge should be thrown across, and the operations commenced under cover of two cat castles, or high movable towers. The Saracens soon destroyed them by throwing quantities of Greek fire, the artillery of that day, upon them, and Louis was forced to think of some other means of effecting his design. A peasant agreed, for a considerable bribe, to point out a ford where the army might wade across, and the Count d'Artois was dispatched with 1,400 men to attempt it, while Louis remained to face the Saracens with the main body of the army. The Count d'Artois got safely over and defeated the detachment that had been sent to oppose his landing. Flushed with victory, the brave Count forgot the inferiority of his numbers and pursued the panic-stricken enemy into Massoura. He was now completely cut off from the aid of his brother crusaders, which the Moslems perceiving, took courage and returned upon him with a force swollen by the garrison of Massoura and by reinforcements from the surrounding districts. The battle now became hand to hand. The Christians fought with the energy of desperate men, but the continually increasing numbers of the foes surrounded them completely and cut off all hope either of victory or escape. The Count d'Artois was among the foremost of the slain, and when Louis arrived to the rescue, the brave advanced guard was nearly cut to pieces. Of the 1,400, but 300 remained. The fury of the battle was now increased threefold. The French king and his troops performed prodigies of valor, and the Saracens, under the command of the Emir Sekadun, fought as if they were determined to exterminate in one last decisive effort the new European swarm that had settled upon their coast. At the fall of the evening dews, the Christians were masters of the field of Massoura, and flattered themselves that they were the victors. Self-love would not suffer them to confess that the Saracens had withdrawn and not retreated, but their leaders were too woefully convinced that that fatal field had completed the disorganization of the Christian army, and that all hopes of future conquest were at an end. Impressed with this truth, the Crusaders sued for peace. The Sultan insisted upon the immediate evacuation of Damietta, and that Louis himself should be delivered as hostage for the fulfillment of the condition. His army at once refused, and the negotiations were broken off. It was now resolved to attempt a retreat, but the agile Saracens, now in the front and now in the rear, rendered it a matter of extreme difficulty and cut off the stragglers in great numbers. Hundreds of them were drowned in the Nile, and sickness and famine worked sad ravages upon those who escaped all other casualties. Louis himself was so weakened by disease, fatigue, and discouragement that he was hardly able to sit upon his horse. In the confusion of the flight, he was separated from his attendants and left a total stranger upon the sands of Egypt, sick, weary, and almost friendless. One night, Geoffrey de Sergine, alone, attended him and led him to a miserable hut in a small village, where for several days he lay in the hourly expectation of death. He was at last discovered and taken prisoner by the Saracens, who treated him with all the honor due to his rank and all the pity due to his misfortunes. Under their care, his health rapidly improved, and the next consideration was that of his ransom. The Saracens demanded, besides money, the cession of Acre, Tripoli, and other cities of Palestine. Louis unhesitatingly refused, and conducted himself with so much pride and courage that the Sultan declared he was the proudest infidel he had ever beheld. After a good deal of haggling, the Sultan agreed to waive these conditions, and a treaty was finally concluded. The city of Damietta was restored, a truce of 10 years agreed upon, and 10,000 gold bezants paid for the release of Louis and the liberation of all the captives. Louis then withdrew to Jaffa and spent 2 years in putting that city and Caesarea, with the other possessions of the Christians in Palestine, into a proper state of defense. He then returned to his own country with great reputation as a saint, but very little as a soldier. Matthew Paris informs us that in the year 1250, while Louis was in Egypt, thousands of the English were resolved to go to the Holy War, had not the king strictly guarded his ports and kept his people from running out of doors. When the news arrived of the reverses and captivity of the French king, their ardor cooled, and the crusade was sung of only, but not spoken of. In France, a very different feeling was the result. The news of the king's capture spread consternation through the country. A fanatic monk of Citeaux suddenly appeared in the villages, preaching to the people, and announcing that the Holy Virgin, accompanied by a whole army of saints and martyrs, had appeared to him, and commanded him to stir up the shepherds and farm laborers to the defense of the cross. To them only was his discourse addressed, and his eloquence was such that thousands flocked around him, ready to follow wherever he should lead. The pastures and the cornfields were deserted, and the shepherds, or pastoureaux, as they were termed, became at last so numerous as to amount to upwards of 50,000. Millot says 100,000 men. The queen, Blanche, who governed as regent during the absence of the king, encouraged at first the armies of the pastoureaux, but they soon gave way to such vile excesses that the peaceably disposed were driven to resistance. Robbery, murder, and violation marked their path, and all good men assisted by the government united in putting them down. They were finally dispersed, but not before 3,000 of them had been massacred. Many authors say that the slaughter was still greater. The 10 years' truce concluded in 1264, and St. Louis was urged by two powerful motives to undertake a second expedition for the relief of Palestine. These were fanaticism on the one hand, and a desire of retrieving his military fame on the other, which had suffered more than his parasites liked to remind him of. The Pope, of course, encouraged his design, and once more the chivalry of Europe began to bestir themselves. In 1268, Edward, the heir of the English monarchy, announced his determination to join the crusade, and the Pope, Clement IV, wrote to the prelates and clergy to aid the cause by their persuasions and their revenues. In England, they agreed to contribute a tenth of their possessions, and by a parliamentary order a 20th was taken from the corn and movables of all the laity at Michaelmas. In spite of the remonstrances of the few clear-headed statesmen who surrounded him, urging the ruin that might in consequence fall upon his then prosperous kingdom, Louis made every preparation for his departure. The warlike nobility were nothing loath, and in the spring of 1270 the king set sail with an army of 60,000 men. He was driven by stress of weather into Sardinia, and while there a change in his plans took place. Instead of proceeding to Acre, as he originally intended, he shaped his course for Tunis on the African coast. The king of Tunis had some time previously expressed himself favorably disposed towards the Christians and their religion, and Louis, it appears, had hopes of converting him and securing his aid against the Sultan of Egypt. "What honor would be mine," he used to say, "if I could become godfather to this Mussulman king?" Filled with this idea, he landed in Africa, near the site of the city of Carthage, but found that he had reckoned without his host. The king of Tunis had no thoughts of renouncing his religion, nor intention of aiding the crusaders in any way. On the contrary, he opposed their landing with all the forces that could be collected on so sudden an emergency. The French, however, made good their first position and defeated the Moslems with considerable loss. They also gained some advantage over the reinforcements that were sent to oppose them. But an infectious flux appeared in the army and put a stop to all future victories. The soldiers died at the rate of 100 a day. The enemy at the same time made as great havoc as the plague. St. Louis himself was one of the first attacked by the disease. His constitution had been weakened by fatigues, and even before he left France he was unable to bear the full weight of his armor. It was soon evident to his sorrowing soldiers that their beloved monarch could not long survive. He lingered for some days and died in Carthage in the 56th year of his age, deeply regretted by his army and his subjects, and leaving behind him one of the most singular reputations in history. He is the model king of ecclesiastical writers, in whose eyes his very defects became virtues, because they were manifested in furtherance of their cause. More unprejudiced historians, while they condemn his fanaticism, admit that he was endowed with many high and rare qualities. That he was in no one point behind his age, and in many in advance of it. His brother, Charles of Anjou, in consequence of a revolution in Sicily, had become king of that country. Before he heard of the death of Louis, he had sailed from Messina with large reinforcements. On his landing near Carthage, he advanced at the head of his army amid the martial music of drums and trumpets. He was soon informed how inopportune was his rejoicing, and shed tears before his whole army, such as no warrior would have been ashamed to shed. A peace was speedily agreed upon with the king of Tunis, and the armies of France and Sicily returned to their homes. So little favor had the crusade found in England that even the exertions of the heir to the throne had only collected a small force of 1,500 men. With these few, Prince Edward sailed from Dover to Bordeaux, in the expectation that he would find the French king in that city. St. Louis, however, had left a few weeks previously, upon which Edward followed him to Sardinia and afterwards to Tunis. Before his arrival in Africa, St. Louis was no more, and peace had been concluded between France and Tunis. He determined, however, not to relinquish the crusade. Returning to Sicily, he passed the winter in that country and endeavored to augment his little army. In the spring, he set sail for Palestine and arrived in safety at Acre. The Christians were torn, as usual, by mutual jealousies and animosities. The two great military orders were as virulent and as intractable as ever, opposed to each other and to all the world. The arrival of Edward had the effect of causing them to lay aside their unworthy contention and of uniting heart to heart in one last effort for the deliverance of their adopted country. A force of 6,000 effective warriors was soon formed to join those of the English prince, and preparations were made for the renewal of hostilities. The Sultan Bibars, or Bendokdar, a fierce Mamluk who had been placed on the throne by a bloody revolution, was at war with all his neighbors and unable for that reason to concentrate his whole strength against them. Edward took advantage of this, and, marching boldly forward to Nazareth, defeated the Turks and gained possession of that city. This was the whole amount of his successes. The hot weather engendered disease among his troops, and he himself, the life and soul of the expedition, fell sick among the first. He had been ill for some time and was slowly recovering when a messenger desired to speak with him on important matters and to deliver some dispatches into his own hand. While the prince was occupied in examining them, the traitorous messenger drew a dagger from his belt and stabbed him in the breast. The wound, fortunately, was not deep, and Edward had regained a portion of his strength. He struggled with the assassin and put him to death with his own dagger, at the same time calling loudly for assistance. The reader will recognize the incident which Sir Walter Scott has introduced into his beautiful romance, The Talisman, and which, with the license claimed by poets and romancers, he represents as having befallen King Richard I. His attendants came at his call and found him bleeding profusely and ascertained on inspection that the dagger was poisoned. Means were instantly taken to purify the wound, and an antidote was sent by the Grand Master of the Templars, which removed all danger from the effects of the poison. Camden, in his history, has adopted the more popular and certainly more beautiful version of this story, which says that the Princess Eleonora, in her love for her gallant husband, sucked the poison from his wound at the risk of her own life. To use the words of old Fuller, "It is a pity so pretty a story should not be true, and that so sovereign a remedy as a woman's tongue, anointed with the virtue of loving affection, should not have performed the good deed." Edward suspected, and doubtless not without reason, that the assassin was employed by the Sultan of Egypt. But it amounted to suspicion only, and by the sudden death of the assassin, the principal clue to the discovery of the truth was lost forever. Edward, on his recovery, prepared to resume the offensive, but the Sultan, embarrassed by the defensive interests which, for the time being, he considered of more importance, made offers of peace to the Crusaders. This proof of weakness on the part of the enemy was calculated to render a man of Edward's temperament more anxious to prosecute the war. But he had also other interests to defend. News arrived in Palestine of the death of his father, King Henry III, and his presence being necessary in England, he agreed to the terms of the Sultan. These were that the Christians should be allowed to retain their possessions in the Holy Land, and that a truce of 10 years should be proclaimed. Edward then set sail for England, and thus ended the last crusade. The after-fate of the Holy Land may be told in a few words. The Christians, unmindful of their past sufferings and of the jealous neighbors they had to deal with, first broke the truce by plundering some Egyptian traders near Margat. The Sultan immediately revenged the outrage by taking possession of Margat, and war once more raged between the nations. Margat made a gallant defense, but no reinforcements arrived from Europe to prevent its fall. Tripoli was next, and other cities in succession, until at last Acre was the only city of Palestine that remained in possession of the Christians. The Grand Master of the Templars collected together his small and devoted band, and, with the trifling aid afforded by the King of Cyprus, prepared to defend to the death the last possession of his order. Europe was deaf to his cry for aid. The numbers of the foe were overwhelming, and devoted bravery was of no avail. In that disastrous siege, the Christians were all but exterminated. The King of Cyprus fled when he saw that resistance was vain, and the Grand Master fell at the head of his knights, pierced with 100 wounds. 7 Templars and as many Hospitallers alone escaped from the dreadful carnage. The victorious Moslems then set fire to the city, and the rule of the Christians in Palestine was brought to a close forever. This intelligence spread alarm and sorrow among the clergy of Europe, who endeavored to rouse once more the energy and enthusiasm of the nations in the cause of the Holy Land. But the popular mania had run its career. The spark of zeal had burned its appointed time and was never again to be reillumined. Here and there a solitary knight announced his determination to take up arms, and now and then a king gave cold encouragement to the scheme, but it dropped almost as soon as spoken of, to be renewed again still more feebly at some longer interval. Now, what was the grand result of all these struggles? Europe expended millions of her treasures and the blood of 2 millions of her children, and a handful of quarrelsome knights retained possession of Palestine for about 100 years. Even had Christendom retained it to this day, the advantage, if confined to that, would have been too dearly purchased. But notwithstanding the fanaticism that originated and the folly that conducted them, the Crusades were not productive of unmitigated evil. The feudal chiefs became better members of society by coming in contact, in Asia, with a civilization superior to their own. The people secured some small installments of their rights. Kings, no longer at war with their nobility, had time to pass some good laws. The human mind learned some little wisdom from hard experience, and, casting off the slough of superstition in which the Roman clergy had so long enveloped it, became prepared to receive the seeds of the approaching Reformation. Thus did the all-wise disposer of events bring good out of evil, and advance the civilization and ultimate happiness of the nations of the West by means of the very fanaticism that had led them against the East. But the whole subject is one of absorbing interest, and if carried fully out in all its bearings, would consume more space than the plan of this work will allow. The philosophic student will draw his own conclusions, and he can have no better field for the exercise of his powers than this European madness, its advantages and disadvantages, its causes and results. The Witch Mania. What wrath of gods, or wicked influence of tears, conspiring wretched men to flict, hath poured on earth this noyous pestilence that mortal minds doth inwardly infect with love of blindness and of ignorance? Spenser's Tears of the Muses. Countrymen, hang her, beat her, kill her. Justice, how now? Forbear this violence. Mother Sawyer, a crew of villains, a knot of bloody hangmen set to torment me, I know not why. Justice, alas, neighbor Banks, are you a ringleader in mischief? Fie to abuse an aged woman. Banks, woman, a she-hellcat, a witch. To prove her one, we no sooner set fire on the thatch of her house, but in she came running as if the devil had sent her in a barrel of gunpowder. Ford's Witch of Edmonton. The belief that disembodied spirits may be permitted to revisit this world has its foundation upon that sublime hope of immortality which is at once the chief solace and greatest triumph of our reason. Even if revelation did not teach us, we feel that we have that within us which shall never die, and all our experience of this life but makes us cling the more fondly to that one repaying hope. But in the early days of little knowledge, this grand belief became the source of a whole train of superstitions, which, in their turn, became the fount from whence flowed a deluge of blood and horror. Europe, for a period of 2 centuries and a half, brooded upon the idea, not only that parted spirits walked the earth to meddle in the affairs of men, but that men had power to summon evil spirits to their aid to work woe upon their fellows. An epidemic terror seized upon the nations. No man thought himself secure, either in his person or possessions, from the machinations of the devil and his agents. Every calamity that befell him he attributed to a witch. If a storm arose and blew down his barn, it was witchcraft. If his cattle died of a murrain, if disease fastened upon his limbs, or death entered suddenly and snatched a beloved face from his hearth, they were not visitations of Providence, but the works of some neighboring hag, whose wretchedness or insanity caused the ignorant to raise their finger and point at her as a witch. The word was upon everybody's tongue. France, Italy, Germany, England, Scotland, and the far north successively ran mad upon this subject, and for a long series of years furnished their tribunals with so many trials for witchcraft that other crimes were seldom or never spoken of. Thousands upon thousands of unhappy persons fell victims to this cruel and absurd delusion. In many cities of Germany, as will be shown more fully in its due place hereafter, the average number of executions for this pretended crime was 600 annually, or 2 every day if we leave out the Sundays, when it is to be supposed that even this madness refrained from its work. A misunderstanding of the famous text of the Mosaic Law, "Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live," no doubt led many conscientious men astray, whose superstition, warm enough before, wanted but a little corroboration to blaze out with desolating fury. In all ages of the world, men have tried to hold converse with superior beings, and to pierce by their means the secrets of futurity. In the time of Moses, it is evident that there were impostors who trafficked upon the credulity of mankind and insulted the supreme majesty of the true God by pretending to the power of divination. Hence the law which Moses, by divine command, promulgated against these criminals, but it did not follow, as the superstitious monomaniacs of the Middle Ages imagined, that the Bible established the existence of the power of divination by its edicts against those who pretended to it. From the best authorities, it appears that the Hebrew word, which has been rendered Benefica and witch means a poisoner and divineress, a dabbler in spells, or fortune-teller. The modern witch was a very different character, and joined to her pretended power of foretelling future events, that of working evil upon the life, limbs, and possessions of mankind. This power was only to be acquired by an express compact, signed in blood, with the devil himself, by which the wizard or witch renounced baptism and sold his or her immortal soul to the evil one, without any saving clause of redemption. There are so many wondrous appearances in nature for which science and philosophy cannot even now account, that it is not surprising that, when natural laws were still less understood, men should have attributed to supernatural agency every appearance which they could not otherwise explain. The merest tyro now understands various phenomena which the wisest of old could not fathom. The schoolboy knows why, upon high mountains, there should on certain occasions appear three or four suns in the firmament at once, and why the figure of a traveler upon one eminence should be reproduced, inverted and of a gigantic stature, upon another. We all know the strange pranks which imagination can play in certain diseases, that the hypochondriac can see visions and specters, and that there have been cases in which men were perfectly persuaded that they were teapots. Science has lifted up the veil and rolled away all the fantastic horrors in which our forefathers shrouded these and similar cases. The man who now imagines himself a wolf is sent to the hospital instead of to the stake, as in the days of the witch mania. And earth, air, and sea are unpeopled of the grotesque spirits that were once believed to haunt them. Before entering further into the history of witchcraft, it may be as well if we consider the absurd impersonation of the evil principle formed by the monks in their legends. We must make acquaintance with the primum mobile and understand what sort of a personage it was who gave the witches, in exchange for their souls, the power to torment their fellow creatures. The popular notion of the devil was that he was a large, ill-formed, hairy sprite, with horns, a long tail, cloven feet, and dragon's wings. In this shape he was constantly brought on the stage by the monks in their early miracles and mysteries. In these representations he was an important personage, and answered the purpose of the clown in the modern pantomime. The great fun for the people was to see him well belabored by the saints with clubs or cudgels, and to hear him howl with pain as he limped off, maimed by the blow of some vigorous anchorite. St. Dunstan generally served him the glorious trick for which he is renowned, catching hold of his nose with a pair of red-hot pincers, till rocks and distant dells resounded with his cries. Some of the saints spat in his face, to his very great annoyance, and others chopped off pieces of his tail, which, however, always grew on again. This was paying him in his own coin, and amused the populace mightily, for they all remembered the scurvy tricks he had played them and their forefathers. It was believed that he endeavored to trip people up by laying his long invisible tail in their way, and giving it a sudden whisk when their legs were over it, that he used to get drunk and swear like a trooper and be so mischievous in his cups as to raise tempests and earthquakes, to destroy the fruits of the earth and the barns and homesteads of true believers, that he used to run invisible spits into people by way of amusing himself in the long winter evenings, and to proceed to taverns and regale himself with the best, offering in payment pieces of gold, which, on the dawn of the following morning, invariably turned into slates. Sometimes, disguised as a large drake, he used to lurk among the bulrushes and frighten the weary traveler out of his wits by his awful quack. The reader will remember the lines of Burns in his address to the Dale, which so well express the popular notion on this point. A dreary, windy winter night, the stars shot down with sclintin' light. With you, Marcel, I got a fright ayont the loch. Ye, like a rash bush, stood in sight with waven soch. The cudgel in my neve did shake, each bristled hair stood like a stake. When an eldritch stour, quake, quake, among the springs, away ye squattered like a drake on whistling wings. In all the stories circulated and believed about him, he was represented as an ugly, petty, mischievous spirit who rejoiced in playing off all manner of fantastic tricks upon poor humanity. Milton seems to have been the first who succeeded in giving any but a ludicrous description of him. The sublime pride, which is the quintessence of evil, was unconceived before his time. All other limners made him merely grotesque, but Milton made him awful. In this the monks showed themselves but miserable romancers, for their object undoubtedly was to represent the fiend as terrible as possible. But there was nothing grand about their Satan. On the contrary, he was a low, mean devil whom it was easy to circumvent and find fun to play tricks with. But, as is well and eloquently remarked by a modern writer, the subject has also its serious side. An Indian deity, with its wild, distorted shape and grotesque attitude, appears merely ridiculous when separated from its accessories and viewed by daylight in a museum. But restore it to the darkness of its own hideous temple, bring back to our recollection the victims that have bled upon its altar or been crushed beneath its car, and our sense of the ridiculous subsides into aversion and horror. So, while the superstitious dreams of former times are regarded as mere speculative insanities, we may be for a moment amused with the wild incoherencies of the patients. But when we reflect that out of these hideous misconceptions of the principle of evil arose the belief in witchcraft, that this was no dead faith but one operating on the whole being of society, urging on the wisest and the mildest to deeds of murder or cruelties scarcely less than murder, that the learned and the beautiful, young and old, male and female, were devoted by its influence to the stake and the scaffold, every feeling disappears except that of astonishment that such things could be, and humiliation at the thought that the delusion was as lasting as it was universal. Besides this chief personage, there was an infinite number of inferior demons who played conspicuous parts in the creed of witchcraft. The pages of Becker, Leloyer, Baudin, Del Rio, and Delancre abound with descriptions of the qualities of these imps and the functions which were assigned them. From these authors, three of whom were commissioners for the trial of witches and who wrote from the confessions made by the supposed criminals and the evidence delivered against them, and from the more recent work of Monsieur Jules Garinet, the following summary of the creed has been with great pains extracted. The student who is desirous of knowing more is referred to the works in question. He will find enough in every leaf to make his blood curdle with shame and horror. But the purity of these pages shall not be soiled by anything so ineffably humiliating and disgusting as a complete exposition of them. What is here culled will be a sufficient sample of the popular belief, and the reader would but lose time who should seek in the writings of the demonologists for more ample details. He will gain nothing by lifting the veil which covers their unutterable obscenities, unless, like Sterne, he wishes to gather fresh evidence of what a beast man is. In that case, he will find plenty there to convince him that the beast would be libeled by the comparison. It was thought that the earth swarmed with millions of demons of both sexes, many of whom, like the human race, traced their lineage up to Adam, who, after the fall, was led astray by devils, assuming the forms of beautiful women to deceive him. These demons increased and multiplied among themselves with the most extraordinary rapidity. Their bodies were of the thin air, and they could pass through the hardest substances with the greatest ease. They had no fixed residence or abiding place, but were tossed to and fro in the immensity of space. When thrown together in great multitudes, they excited whirlwinds in the air and tempests in the waters, and took delight in destroying the beauty of nature and the monuments of the industry of man. Although they increased among themselves like ordinary creatures, their numbers were daily augmented by the souls of wicked men, of children stillborn, of women who died in childbed, and of persons killed in duels. The whole air was supposed to be full of them, and many unfortunate men and women drew them by thousands into their mouths and nostrils at every inspiration. And the demons, lodging in their bowels or other parts of their bodies, tormented them with pains and diseases of every kind, and sent them frightful dreams. St. Gregory of Nyssa relates a story of a nun who forgot to say her Benedicite and make the sign of the cross before she sat down to supper, and who in consequence swallowed a demon concealed among the leaves of a lettuce. Most persons said the number of these demons was so great that they could not be counted, but Virus asserts that they amounted to no more than 7,405,926, and that they were divided into 72 companies or battalions, to each of which there was a prince or captain. They could assume any shape they pleased. When they were male, they were called incubi, and when female, succubi. They sometimes made themselves hideous, and at other times they assumed shapes of such transcendent loveliness that mortal eyes never saw beauty to compete with theirs. Although the devil and his legions could appear to mankind at any time, it was generally understood that he preferred the night between Friday and Saturday. If Satan himself appeared in human shape, he was never perfectly and in all respects like a man. He was either too black or too white, too large or too small, or some of his limbs were out of proportion to the rest of his body. Most commonly his feet were deformed, and he was obliged to curl up and conceal his tail in some part of his habiliments. For, take what shape he would, he could not get rid of that encumbrance. He sometimes changed himself into a tree or a river, and upon one occasion he transformed himself into a barrister, as we learn from Virus, Book 4, Chapter 9. In the reign of Philippe le Bel, he appeared to a monk in the shape of a dark man riding a tall black horse, then as a friar, afterwards as an ass, and finally as a coach wheel. Instances are not rare in which both he and his inferior demons have taken the form of handsome young men, and, successfully concealing their tails, have married beautiful young women who have had children by them. Such children were easily recognizable by their continual shrieking, by their requiring 5 nurses to suckle them, and by their never growing fat. All these demons were at the command of any individual who would give up his immortal soul to the Prince of Evil for the privilege of enjoying their services for a stated period. The wizard or witch could send them to execute the most difficult missions. Whatever the witch commanded was performed, except it was a good action, in which case the order was disobeyed, and evil worked upon herself instead. At intervals, according to the pleasure of Satan, there was a general meeting of the demons and all the witches. This meeting was called the Sabbath, from its taking place on the Saturday, or immediately after midnight on Fridays. These Sabbaths were sometimes held for one district, sometimes for another, and once at least every year it was held on the Brocken, or among other high mountains, as a general Sabbath of the fiends for the whole of Christendom. The devil generally chose a place where 4 roads met as the scene of this assembly, or if that was not convenient, the neighborhood of a lake. Upon this spot nothing would ever afterwards grow, as the hot feet of the demons and witches burnt the principle of fecundity from the earth, and rendered it barren forever. When orders had been once issued for the meeting of the Sabbath, all the wizards and witches who failed to attend it were lashed by demons with a rod made of serpents or scorpions, as a punishment for their inattention or want of punctuality. In France and England, the witches were supposed to ride uniformly upon broomsticks. But in Italy and Spain, the devil himself, in the shape of a goat, used to transport them on his back, which lengthened or shortened according to the number of witches he was desirous of accommodating. No witch, when proceeding to the Sabbath, could get out by a door or window, were she to try ever so much. Their general mode of ingress was by the keyhole, and of egress by the chimney, up which they flew, broom and all, with the greatest ease. To prevent the absence of the witches from being noticed by their neighbors, some inferior demon was commanded to assume their shapes and lie in their beds, feigning illness until the Sabbath was over. When all the wizards and witches had arrived at the place of rendezvous, the infernal ceremonies of the Sabbath began. Satan, having assumed his favorite shape of a large he-goat, with a face in front and another one in his haunches, took his seat upon a throne, and all present in succession paid their respects to him and kissed him in his face behind. This done, he appointed a master of the ceremonies, in company with whom he made a personal examination of all the wizards and witches, to see whether they had the secret mark about them by which they were stamped as the devil's own. This mark was always insensible to pain. Those who had not yet been marked received the mark from the master of the ceremonies, the devil at the same time bestowing nicknames upon them. This done, they all began to sing and dance in the most furious manner until someone arrived who was anxious to be admitted into their society. They were then silent for a while until the newcomer had denied his salvation, kissed the devil, spat upon the Bible, and sworn obedience to him in all things. They then began dancing again with all their might and singing these words: Alegremos, alegremos, que gente va tenemos.